jotted down a few things. A very, very short, I'm going to make a very, very short statement, which I hope might sort of cast some light on what's been said. You know, what? Sorry. We have the film Inter Vista. We have Picasso's history paintings. And we have the manipulation of images and this wonderful word that you use, docufiction. And one wonders, well, what on earth can these things have in common, if anything at all? At the time of the Hungarian uprising, the Hungarian graphic artist, Paul Gabor, gave a toast to create only good works from now on, to wash off the shame of the output of the past 7 years, of this period of idolatry. Just before that, Massacre in Korea and associated works by Picasso formed the basis of a debate in the pages of Das Bildende Kunst in the DDDR. And that discussion was initiated by the painter Heinz Lüdecke in May 1955. And the discussion turned on the limits of realism, and they talked about the work of the Mexican muralists Siqueiros, Orozco, and Rivera, and the Italian communist Renato Gattuso. All of these artists had, in fact, been an inspiration for René Graetz, whom Linda mentioned, who himself saw German Expressionism as a national form of realism, and he kind of campaigned for that, with, you know, less than successfully, obviously. So what are we looking at here? It seems to me these are all involved questions of what could be construed as the objectively real and therefore permissible within national frameworks of socialist realism. And if you'll just bear with me, I'd like to tell you a little anecdote. I was once talking with a former curator of decorative arts from the Prague National Museum, I think. An old man, let's say, who'd his career had developed under the communist regime. And he was showing me this poster of Stalin standing in front of the skyline of Prague. And with all earnestness, he said, he was never here, you know. He never visited, which I thought was really quite an interesting thing for him to say to a Westerner. You know, why was he telling me this? Well, of course, you know, it's a piece of propaganda, as if I wouldn't know that. The point here is that, as Linda has indicated, that there is a history other than formalism in the so-called West, and a nuanced history of art under communism remaining to be written. The talk across the wall, now that the wall has gone, has shifted the discursive frameworks which give culture its meaning. The present, it seems, demands a different past. We're all deaf mutes now in the confrontation with pasts that sometimes we did not know we had and which we have perhaps forgotten. So that's just a little statement, and we'd be very pleased now to take any questions from the audience.
So, last year there was an exhibition in the Berlin History Museum. Unfortunately, I don't recall the title at the moment. But there was this iconic image that probably most of us know of a Soviet soldier on Reichstag after the liberation of Berlin, holding the flag. And as it turns out, this image was also manipulated as we know it. And in actuality, the soldier had six, seven watches that were kind of his war trophies. But I just have a short question, and we cannot apparently trust images, and we cannot trust the documents because they can be manipulated and modified for different ideological purposes and ends. And my question is that What can be the outcome, the implication of this radical skepticism? And for example, when we claim that the Balkan War was a media war, does this mean that it never really happened? Basically, what could be the outcome of this radical skepticism of not trusting documents and images or anything? What would you suggest?
I would say, of course, the Balkan War happened because it's only a statement to be careful, so to say. So it's not necessarily every picture has to be manipulated or has to be in a use for propaganda or for certain different uses. But Balkan War is a very good example because both sides, or let's say all involved sides, used the images in very different ways and tried to make believe us this and that. So I think the best is to be really careful and to have a second or even a third view on the things and try to somehow research if there is a reason for skepticism, if this picture might be true or manipulated. This is really a problem because on the nowadays software you can do everything. So this one example that I showed from the it was a conscious decision to show from an Austrian context because one might know, okay, this doesn't happen there, or but even there on the cover of a main paper, so they have no problem. So this is just then one they write a small letter and say, okay, we are sorry, so it was not our intention, so we just hadn't enough space on the cover. So, but of course it was a conscious decision to manipulate the picture and to somehow bring the whole thing in one direction.
Ask you a question. To what extent, if we are looking at the manipulation of photographs and images, are you asking us to trust the artist making the pieces that you showed, or is that a further level of manipulation that we should be looking at?
I think it's maybe it's better to trust the artist. So
I published an article last year about the famous photograph of Joseph Beuys walking between the rows of police at the time of he was chucked out of the academy in Dusseldorf, and I was there, and I had the press cutting still of the original photograph of that, and it turned out that it must have been Beuys being shown back into the academy, because by the date of the photograph in the newspapers, it wasn't after he was chucked out of the academy, but while he was still a professor at the academy, and he was called back in for a meeting of the Senate. And that photograph is of him coming back in to the meeting of the Senate, and he is amused, you know, and smiling. He's not smiling because he's been kicked out of his post, which is the implication of the context in which that photograph is always reproduced. So you can't always trust the artist either.
This was not an artistic work, this photograph, or was it?
It's a poster by Klaus Steck, but Klaus Steck has been producing it as a poster and as a postcard over the last 25, 30 years. And there was plenty of occasion for Beuys to say, look, this is a misinterpretation of that particular event.
There's a question.
It's not a question, but I think what's really, what's the point is naturally you have this kind of falsifications in political way, but I think when artists use these manipulations, you have naturally a source of creativity and originality. So it's not only a problem, these manipulations, it's also a source of creativity, I think.
Sorry, I wanted to say before that maybe I should extend that sentence. It's better to believe the artists because they are not so suspicious in a way to make us believe this or that. So it's no. So that will not be a political campaign to make us, for example, think that in a war period, this or that is the truth. So it's for this reason, I think it's better to believe the artistic work than the press image, for example.
Yes. Can you get the?
These days there is a restaurant.
I think the questioner was asked. Images gain their meaning from context, and if I'm correct, you were asking what was the context to the images that were shown.
Yeah. I think it was about the relation between image and text, the question also. Yeah. So this was the reason that it was important for me to show this short video of Nebojša Šerić-Šoba. Because the of course there is spoken text as well, but the manipulation in this case is done by the picture. So because first, if you see it, it is about somebody who was killed in Palestine, and everything looks like normal, and then the camera zooms out, and then you think what's going on here? So where is this guy? And so. Šoba was simply using footage from the Netherlands where he was living in that time. So he was on the beach and filming somebody drunk and lying down in the sand. And then he had the idea to put this sequence into that news to show very dramatically the possibilities. So if he would not have zoomed out, nobody would think that something is wrong there. So it's sometimes it's really about details, and of course about the context around. I mean, in Sanja Ivekovic case, she has used, as far as I know, she has used. Models that were in this time also known in Croatia, and so if people look at these images, so they think, okay, I have seen this girl before. There was just one image which was different. I didn't show that, but there was one. It was different. It showed the mother of Sanja Ivekovic, who was also a victim of the Nazi regime. So she was not killed, but she was in Auschwitz as well. But survived. So this, I think this was also the reason for Sanja Ivekovic to work on this topic. And if you see the whole series, it's quite interesting that very long time I didn't know that there is one model is her mother, and the image is like 60 years older. Yes.
Are there any more? Yes, the back. With the white shirt. Yeah.
Hi. This, I suppose, slightly a statement, slightly a question. Like, first of all, like this whole question of fiction and media and history. Like the first thing, okay, the artist, you could maybe say is more truthful, but not really. In one point, they're completely singular, so they have no mass influence. So therefore, their point becomes more like personal perspective. So therefore. They you can't trust them anymore or any less, but it becomes less powerful, so therefore you trust what they say from their perspective. And the second one is that, okay, this idea of the media war, we have this idea at the moment that we must always know what the truth is, and then we question images, and then we know that no image is truthful. And then I would have this question of that there is no existing, like, sort of, in a way history is fictional anyway, and there is no ultimate existing truth. So therefore, it's not until we put that question of fiction into action, and we make some form of action, that it actually becomes a truth again. Like that. Otherwise, it's just we're just taking like fictional viewpoints on like what's like I'm in one country and I take a fictional viewpoint on what's happening in Bosnia, or I take a fictional viewpoint on what's happening in Croatia. But until I take a point of action within what's happening there, I don't think then I have any. Then to me, it's fictional no matter how much I think it's truthful or non-truthful. So I don't know. Maybe you have a comment on, maybe you see this very differently, or it's just this whole idea of fictional. Like to me, it all becomes fictional until there comes a point of action.
Shall I ask my question? I would like to return to the first image that Anton Lehrer showed, so the image of the cover of a newspaper. If I remember well, the most famous example of this kind of manipulation was the cover of National Geographic with the pyramids. And somebody discovered that the image actually was manipulated to compress, similarly as in your example, to compress the pyramids closer to each other so that they fit in the image better. And after this was discovered, well, of course, the National Geographic would defend this manipulation in terms of aesthetic reasons. And I was wondering, how would you explain the manipulation of this particular photo on the cover? Was it really for the compositional reasons, as you said, that they would explain it, the editorial of the magazine? Because what I'm interested in this case is that it actually might happen that the photo is manipulated only for aesthetic reasons, but afterwards, such an image that is much more stronger aesthetically can have actually more impact and can actually trigger some discussions, or can influence the consciousness of people about some facts. And I was wondering if you know other examples of artists who deal with it. I was thinking about the Polish artist Zbigniew Libera, who made kind of stagings of very famous press photographs, and also the German artist Matthias Werner, who also worked with sometimes exactly the same images as Libera. Thank you.
Are we running out of time? Is that? Well, just one more question at the back there, and I'd like to ask a question as well.
It's not a question, it's just a small addition to Anton's talk. You showed Dan Pejowski's cartoon around the end, and you interpreted as a reaction of the, let's say, of the emptiness of the television, TV media. But in this case, it could be also interpreted as a reference to the role of the television in the Romanian so-called revolution, in when the occupation of state TV and the first free TV broadcast had an incredible big impact on the whole situation. So I think this interpretation is a bit more complex, like this very general view that the TV media is representing kind of emptiness, or.
I didn't want to say that it is representing emptiness. I wanted to say
some critique on the TV.
Of course, it's a critique on the TV, but in that sense that the emptiness that was maybe the political emptiness or of emptiness of any content was somehow filled up with something which is represented by this television. But this is the this is the reason that I think that Berezovsky is really a great master, because he understands to put complex circumstances in such signs, and to allow different interpretations as well. And coming back to the question with the, if I think that the image on this newspaper could really have been just manipulated because of aesthetical reasons, I think this is completely unthinkable. So I have to tell a little bit more. These demonstrations, which happened in Austria in the year 2000 and were continued later, were all in all very peaceful. And the newspapers had really problems to find the real pictures to illustrate their interpretation of what's going on. So the interpretation of the newspaper was, it's a leftist mass who wants to make disorder or something like that. But they couldn't find the images, so they had to construct it. I remember a second example. There was a very huge demonstration, and there wasn't even a single picture with some violence. So they put on the cover, they put a stone from the street and said, look, this is the stone they used. Yeah? But they couldn't find one picture where really somebody threw a stone. So there was a lack of pictures, so they had to construct it. And yeah.
Okay, if I can just...
Any chance for a quick question?
Yes, sorry. Okay. Sorry, Ruben, of course.
So I was just very struck, Linda, by the question that you posed during your paper about how would it be possible, if I can summarize it or repeat what you said in other words, like how would it be possible to make an exhibition that addresses the kind of political factors or political distortions that have gone into art history and the making of art history in East and West. I think it's a question, something like that question you posed. And from your paper, what I gained from it is, on the one hand, as we talked about in Manchester, it was more talking about how we need to introduce and bring more attention to what was happening in Eastern Europe in terms of contemporary art and of art in that period, which there's not enough known about in terms of international accounts of art. Also, on the other hand, we need to revise the kind of Western assumptions and accounts. And I just wondered how has the climate changed to allow that to be possible? And now you're embarking on what sounds like a very revisionist approach to the generally accepted picture of Picasso as more a beacon of freedom rather than peace in the West.
I don't know, I was wondering a little bit, why no one had any questions for me, and I thought maybe it was because no one had something nice to say about my paper, because, you know, I was very interested in what kind of reaction there would be to what Ruben calls a kind of revisionism. But from my point of view, if I'm not looking at fame in the West, and inverted commas, famous artist, but looking at art as a more ordinary activity, which is what I found interesting about the AIA work, that one wasn't looking at Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth and St. Ives group, but one was looking at what the majority of artists in exhibiting societies were concerned with over that period of time. And I think that the work that I'm trying to do is only revisionist in that sense, that I'm more interested in art as a social phenomena rather than a fashion magazine. And I'm not interested in just that sense of what's been sorted out as being the fame, which has been manipulated by the kind of manipulations that you were talking about within the art world itself, that manipulation that means the dealers get it right the whole time. How we can look at the social organization of artists in different countries and what was their actual concerns and the context that they produced their work under. And it's very idealistic because we don't have that concept at all in the West of the artist being in a general practitioner in a community in the way that a doctor is a general practitioner within a community. We just have the specialists at the major hospitals in the city centres, and that's the whole of our idea of the practice of contemporary art. So I'm kind of trying to build something a little bit different there. I don't think that's revisionist, particularly.
How do you think that the climate has changed to enable more
What I talked about.
Of Picasso's activities to emerge.
What I talked about was over this 20-year period since it's not going behind the disappearance of the Iron Curtain. This sort of sense of people missing each other, the privileging perhaps in Eastern countries of those people who had much more sympathetic approach towards America and capitalism and those forms and were keen to identify with the West. And at the same time, people like myself in the West who had a great deal of problem with the relationship between one's own countries and America and American culture. And had, like Brodhaus, this sense of the history of the eagle as following the sense of empire, and that America is the current sense of empire, and that Britain is probably one of the key, you know, the aircraft carrier off the coast of Europe. And Churchill called Norwich the bullseye of any future nuclear confrontation, you know, which is where my story started. But I think we've missed each other, and I think it's only now after 20 years with the possibility of more travel and more discussion that a much more interesting picture can begin to emerge. I think it's that kind of negotiating the whole difficulty of exactly what is Europe's relationship to America, and particularly Europe and to Russia, and particularly what is Europe's relationship to America and Russia now that Europe is back together again, and the possibilities of moving around, and the re-exploration of the history which divided us and the history which divided Europe. Wasn't just the Nazi period, but was that Cold War period where Brodhaus' fence got built. The Americans did it in a fun way. The Russians did it in a cruel way. But the results were a similar amnesia of what was our histories in East and West. And that's why I'm finding this Picasso project very interesting as a way of re-looking at a lot of that. And also, it feels like genuine research because I don't know what I'm going to find. But I was very interested to deliberately come here and present the kind of left-wing communist picture that I'd interviewed people and picked up in England and see what the kind of reactions were. Whether I'm just bringing coals to Newcastle, as we say in England, I don't know. That's what I was hoping to hear.